Hello, and thank you for joining us in Mapping the Zone, a podcast usually dedicated to a highly fixated review of large, dense books, specifically the works and context of Thomas Pynchon. This is actually a little impromptu bonus episode that myself and Kate are doing on one of our favorite musicians, David Bowie.
Yeah, 100%. I don't remember how long ago it was that you mentioned it, but you said offhand that like the two of us could probably talk about David Bowie for the entire length of an episode. And I was like, yeah, that's probably true. And so I was walking to work today, listening to David Bowie, and the thought hit me that perhaps that wouldn't be a bad idea to fill some time during this break that we're on.
Yeah, I saw your message. I was like, would I be down to talk about Bowie for a bonus episode? Hell yes. Tell me when. I'm there. What album were you listening to?
I was listening to one of his Live from the Kit Kat Club album.
Okay.
Which was a live performance that happened in 1999.
Nice.
Yeah. Some late 90s Bowie.
So I guess I kind of think the best place to start would be with your, how were you introduced to Bowie? Like, what was the origin story there?
That's a great question. I'm sure that I heard Bowie for the first time, and many times after that, long before I understood who I was listening to. But it actually would have been shortly after I got Spotify high school, I think. I was in high school when, like, predominantly the popular form of music streaming switched from Pandora to Spotify. And so I just, the song Young Americans was the first song I ever heard by David Bowie that I knew. Yeah. That I knew for sure was David Bowie.
Okay.
But there used to be, for any of our listeners who happen to exist in northeastern Wisconsin, there used to be an excellent radio station called 94.3 The Drive FM. It was great. It was like an old school radio station that had different, very distinct DJs as far as what they played. Their morning show was hilarious, and it was a great time. They had a dude who would come on like after 9 or 10 p.m., and he would not say a word for the entirety of his DJ shift, but he would just play vinyl records back to back. And that was all he did. And then they had like one day out of the week where it was dedicated just to playing live recordings rather than studio recordings of music. It was great. It's a great radio station. And when it died, I was so sad. So I'm sure that I heard David Bowie when I was listening to that radio station all the time. But yeah, the first time that I like knew for sure that I was listening to David Bowie was, I was riding home on my long ass bus ride that I had in high school before I had my own car. And on just the sort of radio kind of cue on Spotify, that song by David Bowie came up and I was like, well, this slaps. I love this. Let's purposely listen to some more of this guy's music. So that was where my obsession with David Bowie started.
Nice.
Yeah, what about you?
I can trace it back to when I saw Lost Highway, which would have been, I was in high school, so that would have been like 2000. I knew who he was. It's one of those things of like, kind of like you were saying, like I knew he was a musician. I had probably heard his music before and just never really clocked what it was. I watched Labyrinth as a kid, but I never really knew like, okay, that's David Bowie. You know, I wouldn't have placed him outside of that other than just, he's the Goblin King in that movie. But it wasn't ever something that my parents would listen to. My dad was really into like, If he wasn't listening to 90s country music, he was listening to 80s hair metal. So never going to hear it there. My mom was typically listening to either John Denver or Amy Grant. So
there you go.
Bowie was too weird for them.
Yeah.
But I started getting into other bands that were wildly influenced by him in middle school, like Nine Inch Nails, Marilyn Manson, Smashing Pumpkins, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then when I saw Lost Highway, I was like, holy shit, this is like, aside from being a great movie, the soundtrack on that movie is phenomenal. So I went and I grabbed a copy of that from, I think it was CD Warehouse in San Antonio.
Nice. And, okay.
I put it on, and the first song on there is I'm Deranged by Bowie. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is incredible. I need to listen to more of his stuff. And I knew already that he was a huge influence on Trent Reznor, who was and still is one of my favorite musicians. And I knew specifically from reading interviews that Lowe was like arguably the biggest influence on the Downward Spiral of any other record in Reznor's life at that time. So I think it was either the next day or a couple days after I went back to CD Warehouse and picked up a copy of Lowe, and that album did not leave my CD player for the better part of a couple months. if it did, it was going from my CD player in my room to the CD player in my car. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with his stuff. I have really just loved most of what he's done. And now I'm passing the torch on to my kids. They're big Bowie fans now. And we have a life-size David Bowie cutout in our living room that acted as a Christmas tree this year, him and Freddie Mercury. So strung up in life.
I love that. Yeah. Yeah. I don't quite have a cardboard cutout, but I have a absolutely massive canvas print of him that hangs above my couch. Nice. Yeah, I think that actually I like that you brought up Lost Highway and Labyrinth, because I'm pretty sure that the first time I ever saw David Bowie was his appearance as Pontius Pilate in The Last Temptation of Jesus Christ.
I forgot he was in that.
Yeah, he's in one scene. Where Pontius Pilate talks to Jesus, and it's really good. Like His acting in that scene in particular is amazing. I saw the fact that this guy showed up who has heterochromia, who actually, believe it or not, David Bowie did not have heterochromia. It's just the one of his eyes looked different because of how dilated it was. But it's like this guy with two different colored eyes is playing Pontius Pilate. Who the hell is that? And so I Googled it, and I was like, David Bowie? That guy that my mom says is a freak, because that is how my mom described him, and probably why I didn't listen to a good chunk of his music for quite a long time. It's kind of know he was an actor too, and that was probably, you know, maybe like a year or less before Young Americans came up on Shuffle.
That's one of the. We'll circle back to his acting later, because he is a good actor. And I've really enjoyed a lot of the films that he's in. So as far as him as a musician, because that is primarily his, you know, his career was as a musician. Mm-hmm. I think what really drew me to him and what really got me to connect to his music, especially because it's, you know, when you look at really any generation, I think there's always a tendency to kind of, you know, you're exposed to the music your parents listen to. And if you have like an older sibling, they may influence what you listen to as well. But it's, I think often it's the music that you discover at a certain age that kind of sticks with you. And it's really, I think, pretty rare for older musicians, like, you know, musicians who were making music 20 or 30 years before you are listening to it for the first time. It's rare for that to kind of connect with a younger generation a lot of times, but I found myself, especially in high school and early in college, really getting into a lot of musicians and bands from the 60s and 70s, Bowie and Neil Young and The Cure and Iggy Pop and The Stooges and all this stuff that, you know, I had the bands and the artists that I liked, and then I wanted to know where their influences came from, because as a musician, I think there's that kind of inherent tendency to kind of understand, you know, what influenced the people that influence you. And so I could almost always draw a line between my favorite artists and Bowie. And I understood why, especially after, you know, when I finally picked up other albums than Low and the Lost Highway soundtrack, and really got to experience what he was capable of in the really kaleidoscopic nature of his output. Because there's really, he doesn't have any two albums that really sound the same. There are some through lines here and there, mm-hmm. but everything he has done is just so unique and different, whether or not it's good. He had some duds that I'm not really a huge fan of, but he was always pushing the envelope and really trying to explore what music could be and how different elements could plug into what already existed at the time to kind of push things forward. That experimentation, I think, is a big part of what really attracted me to his music and has kept me engaged with his music over all these years.
Yeah, I agree. Like, similar to yourself, like, you have those influences from, like, your parents, or if you have an older sibling, or just, like, an older adult figure who's a safe person in your life who also listens to music. Like, I had a lot of those. And, you know, my dad listens to music from, like, the 60s and 70s in particular, but thought David Bowie was a weirdo. And then my mom listened to music from the 80s, but thought David Bowie was a freak. So none of the influences that I had in my life from a standpoint of music, they both skipped over this artist that would have, in theory, bridged the gap between their two interests, especially from a time frame perspective, because my dad hated music from the 80s and my mom hated music from the 60s and 70s. And then like, they refused to listen to each other's musical interests, which I thought was very interesting. And what I was listening to kind of became like a point of contention for my parents. Like, they would get upset if I was more invested in one of their musical interests versus the other. It was this weird like turf war they had. And so it wasn't until I kind of checked out of the whole thing and just was listening to jazz, because I was a jazz musician at that time in my life, like,
nice,
that, you know, I escaped that turf war because neither of them listened to jazz. But it was this weird thing where I just missed it. And then when I started to get more like invested in his music, to your point, the thing that kept me so invested, as opposed to other artists that you kind of like come across and become interested in, was just how ahead of his time everything sounded.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think I'll ever forget the visceral reaction that I had, and visceral in a positive way, not in a negative way, of when I put on Scary Monsters and Super Creeps for myself for the first time, and the first song transitions from a VHS tape being played with, like, that audio effect being included, mm-hmm. to the, like, heavy guitars and David Bowie, and then a drum build to a Japanese woman speaking, or potentially, in my mind, an audio clip from an anime that maybe he just had on VHS, and that was what he was trying to portray in the song. I'll never forget hearing that and being like, people don't even attempt to do this now, really. Like, they kind of do. But, like, no one would have been doing this in, when was that? I think that album was released in 1980. No one was attempting to do something like that in 1980. And just how consistently I had those reactions to the music that he was producing. Because, like, The Man Who Sold the World was 1970, and that's like a proto-metal album almost.
Yeah.
You know, between like Black Country Rock, Width of a Circle, and, you know, a couple of those other heavier cuts off that record, just this consistent like discovery of, oh, this is another sound he did. This is another sound he did. And also, it's always a decade ahead of everyone else who did this.
Yep.
It's very, very fascinating.
Yeah. There aren't a lot of, and this isn't a knock against really any other musicians necessarily, but there aren't a lot of artists who can sustain that level of creativity throughout their career. Mm-hmm. I think there's a big difference between, you know, being able to consistently release albums and, you know, whether or not they're good is beside the point, but to be able to keep them of a certain consistency and to maintain a certain sound to where you would hear it and say, oh, that's this band or that's this singer or whatever the case may be. But it's rare for an artist to be able to shift style so often and so drastically, mm-hmm. especially sometimes within a very short period of time. And to still be able to retain the quality of songwriting that he was able to maintain. I mean, that speaks to not just his talent as a musician, but also to why he was so influential and why his influence is so far reaching. I mean, you'll find artists in almost every genre of music who will cite him as an influence on what they have done. I mean, he's had his fingers in every type of music short of, you know, straight country music.
Yeah, right.
But he's flirted with that style. Mm-hmm. He's never really gone full into that, but pretty much every other genre he has, you know, at least dabbled in or toyed with in some way or another. And it just makes for such a unique listening experience. And it's kind of, if we want to tie this into Pynchon, I think it lends itself to a level of re-listenability that you can go back to it and always kind of discover something new in it, no matter how many times you have engaged with that album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And especially from a standpoint of like, because of what you're talking about with how often he changed styles, how many genres he dabbled in and all of that, you can come back to the same music of his that you've listened to, you know, 5-10 years later and have a completely different understanding of that music based upon what else you have been listening to. And
yeah,
like the best example that I can think of is when it's in the bonus material at the end of one of our episodes where we were talking about David Bowie, or I was talking about listening to like a lot of David Bowie last year, and you had mentioned that Station to Station was your favorite album. And I was like, that is a good one, but I haven't listened to it in a while. And then immediately after I listened to it again, like I had a completely different understanding and appreciation for what he was putting together in that record. Especially with the title track. That title track is insane.
Yeah. So good.
Yeah. Although I think TVC15 is my favorite song on the album, that I had a completely different, different understanding and approach to that record, to the point where it's gotta be my favorite at this point. I like, it's difficult for me to do that to Low, but, you know, I think Station to Station is the better album.
That was my situation for a long time too. Low was my favorite for a very long time. And then something about Station to Station just clicked when I listened to it. And mm-hmm. I was like, okay, this is, how have I not heard this in this context before? And it's especially wild considering that he has absolutely zero memory of making that particular album.
So much cocaine.
That was when he was subsiding on cocaine, milk and peppers. I think white peppers specifically or something like that. Some kind of color of pepper during his time in Berlin. And then the fact that he had to detox with Iggy Pop, like that's.
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah,
but not before the two of them did a bunch of coke together, you know,
all of the cocaine that was in that area probably. Yeah.
I think I told this story in previous bonus like material that I've already referenced, but that whole story with David Bowie and Iggy Pop is interesting because David Bowie just really liked Iggy Pop's music with the Stooges, mm-hmm. and then like heard that he was broke and in a halfway house and that the Stooges had broken up because their guitarist had overdosed and died. And so just showed up at his halfway house and was like, yeah, I'm gonna like get the fuck out of Los Angeles because this place has ruined my life. And the other interesting thing about David Bowie in Los Angeles is he went there purposely because he knew it would ruin his life. Like he was aware that it was gonna be this like psychic drain on him, but he went anyway just to see what that would create musically for him. And he was like, you know, do you just want to come with me? I'm gonna go to Germany. There's all these interesting like kraut rock bands that, you know, are forming over there. And I'm always gonna be so pissed that the album that he would have recorded with members of Can and Faust never happened because his publicist thought that it was going to be a like career suicide move. That will always make me so mad. But the fact that he just scooped Iggy Pop up, they went to Germany, and there's a story from this period where before both of them like detoxed and went clean, where David Bowie ran out of cocaine and so drove Iggy Pop to what he thought was his dealer's house.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And pulled his like his BMW or whatever it was up onto the lawn of this house, and then proceeded to walk up to the door and started just pounding on this door, trying to get his dealer's attention so he could buy more coke. And then just some random woman came to the door, and it turned out that he was just at the completely wrong house. Like, I have no clue how I would react if someone was pounding on my door and I opened it, and it was Iggy Pop and David Bowie standing side by side, clearly whacked out of their mind on drugs. And behind them, their car is on my lawn. I don't know how I would deal with that.
That would be absolutely wild. I had forgotten about that story. Jesus. Oh.
Yeah, absolutely nuts.
And I'm glad, you know, speaking of Iggy Pop, that touches on another part of Bowie's history in music, is not only as a musician and performer, but also as a producer, because he did produce arguably the best Stooges album with Raw Power, which was the source of a lot of controversy due to the way it was. Initially, it was because of how it was mixed, but I think Iggy Pop said later that it wasn't that it was mixed poorly; it was mastered badly, is what it was,
and
that
was
the cause of a lot of and so it caused a lot of consternation. And either way, Raw Power is a fucking phenomenal album.
It's a great album.
I mean, really, any Stooges album is great, but I go back and forth between Funhouse and Raw Power as far as like which of those is my favorite. But I think most days Raw Power will take that title.
I don't think I can ever move past Funhouse. That is a perfect album from beginning to end, and there's no reason to skip any of it. And that saxophone player that Iggy Pop just found, I think, like bumming around a hotel pool.
Sounds right.
And was just like, "Hey, do you want to be in the Stooges?" And it was just this like, I think he was like 15. And had never done drugs in his life. And obviously, unfortunately, he got hooked on like heroin while he was in the Stooges, but it produced some of the most insane saxophone parts in any proto-punk, proto-metal album ever recorded. Like that saxophone, and it, you know, that's probably, I'm biased because I also am a saxophone player, but like that element of the album, I think, is what pushes it above for me.
It is. It's. I mean, I'm not going to argue that it's one's better than the other necessarily, because, like I said, I go back and forth on them all the time. Yeah. So, just, you know, it's the Stooges. You really can't go wrong.
True.
But getting back to Bowie, do you have? I know you mentioned. I think both of us agree right now, at least, that Station to Station is our favorite album. Do you have a particular era of his that you're more particular? Do you like his sort of like earlier stuff, you know, from the self-titled up to about like just about Ziggy Stardust era? Are you more of a fan of the kind of experimental Berlin era? The I know pretty much no one's a big fan of the 80s era. It was what it was. Or do you like some of the later stuff? Like what era of Bowie do you find yourself kind of going back to more and more?
You know, I think I sent you a message about this, but like His run from basically The Man Who Sold the World until Let's Dance is like the greatest run of albums by any artist probably ever in history.
And it's a lot of albums too. It's not a few.
It is exactly a decade, 13 years technically, if we're including Let's Dance, which I only really like the A side of, but
13 albums.
Yeah, The Man Who Sold the World, Hunky Dory, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, Aladdin Sane, Pinups, Diamond Dogs, Young Americans, Station to Station, Low, Heroes, Lodger, Scary Monsters and Super Creeps, and then Let's Dance. That's there's no bad albums there.
No.
Like Pinups is skippable because it's covers, but like none of these records are bad whatsoever. I would say that if I had to stick to a particular era, it would be the Thin White Duke era of mm-hmm. David Bowie, which, you know, some people controversially or otherwise say that the Thin White Duke existed only for one record, which is Station to Station. I disagree.
Yeah, no, I'm not.
I would say the Station to Station to Lodger is all the Thin White Duke, but it is like it's the Thin White Duke gradually putting his life together.
Yeah.
From being in the worst possible position in life in Station to Station until finally like reconciling his demons with his life experience on Lodger. So I would say that like that particular period, those five records, yeah, would be, and you know what, Scary Monster and Super Creeps, I'll throw that in there too. Not a Thin White Duke album, but I love that record.
Good album.
Yeah, those five albums I would say are my favorite period of his work. You know, yeah, that's where I would end up. Like if I could only, you know, take five records consecutively, that would be where I would end up.
I can't argue with that. I mean, it's an incredible run within an incredible run of albums.
Right.
And I can't really think of many other artists that have that level of consistency over that length of time, over that length of that many albums too. Like, you know, it's one thing to put out 2, 3, 4 albums in, you know, 13, 12 years, but to put out 13 albums in a little over 10 years is nothing short of incredible. Mm-hmm. It's astonishing. I'm with you though. I think the same era is probably my preferred. I do find myself weirdly kind of going back to some of his like 90s albums, specifically Outside was an amazing album. And Earthling was pretty good too. And then, I mean, Black Star is, I have probably listened to that one more recently than a lot of his other stuff, but that may just be recency bias also.
I haven't listened to it.
You haven't listened to it at all?
Nope.
I am shocked.
As soon as he died and it became very clear to me what Black Star as a record is, I told myself that was going to be the last thing I ever listened to by him. So I am listening to every single live album.
Oh, so you're working your way through everything.
I'm listening to everything. And then eventually when there's no more Bowie left to listen to, I will listen to his eulogy.
Okay. I have to know your thoughts when you've listened to it because I love that album. It's phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very much looking forward to when I eventually get to that.
Yeah, it's still weird to me to think of the fact that he doesn't walk this earth anymore.
It doesn't feel correct. And also,
it doesn't.
If I may point out, the world has kind of sucked since he died.
That was the match that got thrown in the dumpster.
And I really think that there was something about him continuing to exist that really kept the world together.
The glue that kept everything going.
Yeah, and now that he's gone, just the kind of whole house of cards is slowly falling apart.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's been a real wild ride since then. I'm looking back at his discography, and you know, I mentioned earlier that the 80s wasn't the best. And for anyone listening who isn't really familiar with Bowie, I don't want to say that there's nothing worth listening to during that period. There are some good songs on some of those albums. The A side of Let's Dance is pretty good. The Labyrinth soundtrack isn't bad.
Tonight is skippable because it's covers. And also, he himself said, "I wish I didn't record that."
Yeah, that's true. But he did, you know, so he did help kind of bring up some younger musicians during that time. Let's Dance was, I think, technically the recording debut of Stevie Ray Vaughan.
That sounds correct. So
he, you know, he kind of helped prop him up and also brought Stevie Ray Vaughan to Montreux, where everyone hated him the first time he played there and then loved him the second time he played there. But that, I think that just speaks to Bowie's ability to recognize talent where, others may not have seen it.
Mm-hmm.
But it, you know, yeah, it's not the best. And thankfully it's a short period of time. There aren't a lot of albums between Scary Monsters and his, I would say Black Tie White Noise was kind of a return to better output.
Yeah,
so there's not
correct.
A whole lot that you're missing between there. And I was actually just listening to that album again today. And yeah, that album holds up a little bit better than I thought it would.
There's like literally two albums that you should take out of his discography, and it's Tonight and Never Let Me Down. And
Never Let Me Down was rough.
I still don't really know what that is.
It's, you know, the cover should do a pretty good job of explaining why you might want to stay away from it.
Yeah, that's fair.
But he came roaring back in the 90s. I mean, Black Tie White Noise was pretty good. Outside is probably one of my favorite of his albums. I think it's an interesting attempt at a concept album.
Yeah,
a very loose concept album, but it is still there.
Earthling is also great.
Earthling is great. That was the first time I remember seeing Bowie in any kind of like performing aspect, because the music video for I'm Afraid of Americans with Reznor,
mm-hmm.
Was all over MTV at the time. That's still one of my favorite music videos. That album was really cool. It's like, again, you know, he's pushing the envelope in 97 and making this essentially like jungle breakbeat album that was right around the time, right? Just, I think that album came out just before bands like Prodigy and like Crystal Method and all that stuff kind of really started hitting an increase in popularity.
Mm-hmm.
But then Hours was a pretty cool record. I go back to that one pretty frequently. Heathen, I was re-listening
Heathen's
to today.
A freaking great album.
That one, and there's some cool covers on there. I had forgotten that Cactus was a Pixies cover until I heard it, and I was like, what is this Pixie song doing in this album? Then I was like, oh yeah, Frank Black wrote it. There's a good Neil Young cover in that album too.
Dave Grohl and Pete Townsend are both on that album.
Yes, Dave Grohl is on the Neil Young song. I think that's the one he plays on. It sounds right. I mean, the guy just was amazing. I cannot, like, there are a few artists that I have really held close to my heart that have the discography that is comparable to his in size and quality.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, you know, Bowie's one of those musicians that I will just really never get tired of talking about, in any aspect. I just, the fact that he's gone and we're not going to get any more music just really fucking kills me.
Well, the Record Store Day release this year has a couple of unreleased tracks from Ziggy Stardust.
Yeah.
So that's some slightly new Bowie content.
Something to look forward to. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But we mentioned earlier, I wanted to circle back to his acting, because that was the other, I think, big part of his career was as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously Labyrinth was like the vehicle for him. That was the movie that he was kind of put into the spotlight for. And I don't think he had another movie where he was the, not necessarily the lead, but he had as big a part.
Man Who Fell to Earth.
Thank you. Yes. Which is a fantastic film and is insanely hard to find.
Yeah.
I had a copy of that. I had the Criterion copy of that for a while, and it got stolen when I was in college.
He was also the main character in Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence.
I don't think I ever saw that.
He plays a POW in a Japanese war camp in World War II.
Okay. Interesting.
It's actually pretty good.
But then, yeah, Last Temptation of Christ, I forgot he was in that entirely. He was in Twin Peaks in the prequel film Fire Walk with Me. He plays Philip Jeffries.
And
then, was replaced by a very large tea kettle in their return, which is great. I mean, it just, that was perfect.
I feel like one of these years for Halloween, I'm going to dress up as Philip Jeffries, because that's quite an outfit, an oversized white blazer and pants, and then a tropical button down shirt.
Yeah, that was, he had quite the look in that movie. That's a fucking awesome movie, though.
And also has a southern accent for no discernible reason. Yeah.
I remember watching that for the first time. I was like, why the fuck is Bowie talking like this? What? Okay, I'm on board. Don't get me wrong. But that's a choice. He played himself in Zoolander. And then, oh, God, he was in Extras. Jesus, I forgot about that. If you haven't watched Extras, that is such a funny show. And I forgot about the fact that he's in there. And that's a fucking hilarious episode.
It's from before Ricky Gervais was insufferable.
Yeah, when he was still funny and making worthwhile content on television. And then The Prestige. I loved The Prestige. And his portrayal of Nikola Tesla was great.
Really good.
So, if for some reason, if you haven't seen The Prestige and you're listening to this, go watch The Prestige. It's a great Christopher Nolan film.
It is. It probably is the most overlooked one other than his first movie.
It is. Oh, Following?
Yeah.
Yeah. Following was pretty good.
I do enjoy it. It's a head scratcher.
It is. So yeah, it's rare for someone who is as talented a musician as he is to also be a legitimately good actor.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the man was just insanely talented, and I'm trying to think, is there anything else? I have a couple other things I want to get to as far as like his outward connections in the music world, but as far as his work itself, was there anything else that you wanted to touch on?
Are there any albums of his, and I guess potentially I'm just setting myself up for real criticism here, but like, are there any albums of his that you aren't as hyped on, or like don't understand the monumental like credit they get? If that makes sense.
Yeah. I see where you're coming from. I don't think his first album is overhyped necessarily, because I don't think it was like seen as this monumental thing. I do think that Space Oddity is a good song. I don't think it's anywhere close to his best work. It's a fun song to listen to, but it's I don't know, it is what it is. I don't know that I would say any particular album in general is necessarily overblown. I know there's some of his albums that I personally don't think, or I don't enjoy. I shouldn't say I don't enjoy. I don't go back to as much as some other people might. Especially like Hunky Dory. I like it. It's not one I'm going to constantly go back to.
Yeah, it's fine.
It's a good listen, but yeah, I'm not going to like go out of my way to listen to it. I would say really probably the only other one that Aladdin Sane is probably the only other one I don't really go back to. And that's, I would say, maybe also the only time where he had, I don't want to say he just kind of duplicated Ziggy Stardust, but it was the closest like musically to the album before it that he had done at the time and did any more in his career. I think those two albums are kind of two sides of the same coin in a way.
It's Ziggy going to America is what Aladdin Sane really is.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, there's great songs on there, but it's not one that I find myself constantly going back to. So.
Yeah. Agreed on both counts. I will also say, I think Ziggy Stardust is a bit overrated.
I'll give you that. Yeah. It's a great album, but
it's a bit inconsistent tonally. Across the whole record for me to really understand the obsession that a lot of people have with it. Like, the songs that are really good on Ziggy Stardust are really, really good. But a lot of it, and I guess potentially what has potentially been filled in sort of in the gaps with this record start date release this year is a lot of it seems like maybe it was just a lot of songs they had in the studio and then wanted to use, but didn't necessarily have a whole, you know, thought for how to structure them, mm-hmm. or maybe were worried about this, the album being too long, and so they cut out portions of it. I don't know, but that's one of those ones that, like, every time I go back to listen to it, I'm just waiting for something in my brain to switch over and be like, yeah, this is, like, incredibly brilliant, and it's one of the greatest things he ever produced, but I don't know. I don't think I'm ever going to get there with that.
Yeah, I would agree, and I've listened to it a lot. And I remember specifically having a similar conversation. This would have been, God, almost 20 years ago when I was in a band and we were playing a show. It was just me and the guitarist because our bassist was sick. And we were sitting backstage in this little club that we were going to play, and they had Ziggy Stardust on. We ended up listening to most of it in there, and he was just kind of going on and on about how that was his favorite Bowie album. And I let him run his spiel, and I was like, it's good, but it's not low. It's not Station to Station. It's not mm-hmm. Heroes. Like, it's a fine album, but I don't think that album does a good job of encapsulating Bowie at his best.
Yeah, agreed.
Now, I will say I do listen to that one a lot because it is my kid's favorite album, and there's something awesome about singing Starman at the top of our lungs with the windows down.
Yeah, no, that is a great song to belt out. Yeah. I also am a big fan of over-dramatizing 5 years, particularly towards the end of that song when he just keeps saying 5 years, and then that other like the doubled vocal comes in the back and just keeps getting more and more strained. I enjoy performing that in a way over exaggerated fashion, particularly at karaoke with my friends. I think they maybe heard me scream "my brain hurts a lot" more than probably anything else.
Oh, that's awesome. So the other thing I wanted to bring up, this kind of is tangential but still connected to Bowie. So you know, as I mentioned earlier, like, I got into Bowie essentially through the other artists that he worked with and or influenced. But more so as I've grown into his music over the years, and kind of been able to see the actual collaborations that he has done with some of my favorite artists. That's where it's like, it's really interesting to see the connection between, you know, these two different bands and how he influenced their sound, because you can hear like the songs that he's on simultaneously sound like a song of that band, but sound like one of his songs too. Like, they would fit perfectly on either person's or either artist's discography. So starting with Nine Inch Nails, in I think it was 95, he toured with, they did a co-headlining tour. And what was really cool about it was they would essentially, like, one band would be the opener, the other band would be the headliner, but they would have a set in the middle where they were playing each other's songs together. So you would have Bowie's band out with Nine Inch Nails, and they're both playing Bowie songs and Nine Inch Nails songs as they blend into whoever was headlining that night. And so there's some really cool performances on YouTube. I'll have to find the link to it and put it in the show notes, but it was a really cool kind of thing to watch, because you would have you know, this whole Bowie set, and then Nine Inch Nails would come out, but Bowie would stay on stage. They would start playing, you know, stuff from Scary Monsters or stuff from some of the I think Outside was the album he was touring at that time. So they'd be playing that stuff, and then they would be blending in stuff from like Downward Spiral with it. And then you know, whoever was headlining would go over into it. It's really cool to watch, and you can really see, like, when you're watching him and Reznor sing together, you can really see where that influence kind of came off on Reznor, and like, it really shines. And I think he's put a lot of that into his music itself as well. But watching those two perform together was really something. And I really wish I could have been old enough to have seen that. That was a little bit, I would have been 11, I think, during that tour.
Perfect age.
So it's been waiting. Hell, my parents would have let me go to that.
I'm surprised none of those, I didn't know that. That's really cool. I'm surprised none of those performances have been like released as a live recording. Like, the fact that they've never done that seems surprising to me.
I think there's bootlegs out there. I know there's videos on YouTube, and I'll find it and dump it on the Discord for you later, and I'll put it in the show notes. Because it's a really cool thing to watch.
Yeah, I bet.
It's a really good era. And then after that, so when I went to high school, I moved out of San Antonio to a small town just outside of it. That's where I ended up meeting my wife. And she got me into Placebo when we were both in high school.
Okay.
And if you're not familiar with Placebo,
I phenomenal am. Band.
Absolutely love them. Bowie was on a recording of Without You, I'm Nothing, which is one of my Placebo songs. I don't know. Have you heard the version of that with him on it?
I don't think I have.
It gives it a whole kind of new atmosphere and vibe to hear his voice on there.
Okay.
That's a really cool one too. And then the other collaboration, and I didn't know this existed until today. And this is, I mentioned earlier this morning when we started talking about doing this episode that my wife and I had a conversation yesterday, about that kind of tied into this. So we were talking in the car, and I don't know how it just popped into my head. I was like, hey, if you had the opportunity to collaborate on one song with either David Bowie or Robert Smith, who Ooh. Would you decide to go with?
Yeah.
This became like a 20-minute back and forth between us of like, well, you know, Bowie's got this and this and this, but Robert Smith has this and this and this. And so we ended up, I think she ended up saying Bowie, and I went with Robert Smith. Mm-hmm. I found a video of them performing together.
Oh, really?
It's really cool. So I'll put that in the show notes as well. I had no idea they ever collaborated. I kind of figured they would have run in the same circles, mm-hmm. but I never thought they would have collaborated on anything. So that was really cool to hear. Because The Cure has been one of my favorite bands for around the same time I got into Bowie. And Disintegration is maybe one of the most listened to albums I have.
That's my favorite one of theirs too.
It's absolutely phenomenal. I genuinely cannot get tired of listening to that record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is an amazing record. Yeah, I think my answer to that would have to be Bowie. I'd want to collaborate with Bowie. But Robert Smith would certainly be up there as somebody to collaborate with for sure. I think it's also interesting too, like when you get into David Bowie's later stuff, when he was like openly discussing other music that was being released and like the stuff he was listening to. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know, his favorite band was Arcade Fire.
Really?
I don't remember what interview this was in, but somebody asked him what his favorite band was, and his response was, of all time, his favorite band was Arcade Fire. That's
wild.
Yeah, because he's on Reflector. And so I believe it was between Neon Bible and Reflector that he said this, and then Arcade Fire was like, well, you know, if you want to record with us, like, you can. You know, so I like, that is one of those things where that's a really cool piece of trivia to know. I feel like if I learned that I was David Bowie's favorite band, I'd need to stop making music. Like, I don't think that I would be capable of managing that expectation for the rest of my creative output. And I'd have to
That would live in the back of my mind every time I was writing a song.
Yeah.
Would just be like, what is Bowie going to think about? Like, he's going to listen to this. I know he's going to listen.
David Bowie's going to listen to this album, and I'm his favorite musician. I need to put out something worth listening to. Which, you know, it would appear as though they lost sight of that with their most recent record. Don't listen to it. It's not worth your time.
I have no desire to.
But he also noted in an interview shortly before he died that Death Grips was a large influence on Black Star.
I need a minute to process this statement. That's interesting.
Which, to think that that's also what he was listening to around the time that he died, and enjoyed it to such a degree that there was some creative, you know, turnover there from them to his final record, is pretty crazy just to think about conceptually.
Yeah, I'm thinking about how that would plug into that album, and
I think it's the drums.
I think I can see it. Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, with what knowledge I do have of that album, because I've deliberately watched zero reviews, read zero about it. I've heard the title track, and that's it. So yeah, I have a feeling it's the drums, but it's pretty crazy to me that's how far his listening went was Death Grips, which, you know, when you think about that interview between him and the MTV guy, where he basically called out MTV for not playing hip hop music when it was the biggest thing in the country, and subtly called them all racist. It shouldn't surprise me, but Death Grips is out there for hip hop. So
yeah, those are two sentences I never thought I would hear, is that his favorite band was Arcade Fire and the Death Grips was a big influence on him. But
yeah,
you learn something every day, right?
So true. So true.
So the other kind of non-musical connections that I wanted to bring up regarding Bowie was, and I've talked about this before, my love for the Venture Brothers TV show.
I was going to ask you to bring that up.
if no one has seen it, please, for the love of God, watch this show. It is consistently maybe my favorite comedy show, maybe just general TV show. It was 7 seasons stretched out over almost 20 years. Like, they really took their time building the story and making sure it was written as well as possible. But in the early seasons, the first 3-4 seasons, David Bowie was legitimately a major character in the show. And they, throughout the series, just gush on Bowie. There are conversations about Bowie's albums and different eras of his life that are peppered in there. There's entire scenes in a couple of episodes that feature David Bowie, Iggy Pop, and Klaus Kinski, which are some of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. And they're like, it's a show that's already riddled with pop culture references and music history references, this kind of stuff. But when they get down to the level of just really interesting and very hyper focused references to Bowie and his works, it's absolutely incredible. And there's a compilation of clips from his character on the show that I'll post in the show notes as well. But the other show that I thought did a really good job of lovingly paying tribute to him was Flight of the Conchords. They did a whole song in the style of David Bowie throughout his career. Like, it's a 3-minute distillation of the first like 20 years of his career. And it's absolutely hilarious. So that's another one to check out as well.
Honestly, Flight of the Conchords is something that more people should look up. So I feel like they really went unnoticed during their time on the planet.
They really did. And it's a shame because that show was phenomenal. Their early like stand-up performances where it was just them performing their songs, hilarious. Mm-hmm. Those guys are just great. I love them.
And yeah, big
they've,
fan.
They've gone off to do all kinds of great stuff. I was thinking, it's been in the back of my mind since we started talking about that 10-year run that you mentioned. And I kept thinking, like, I know there's someone else that had a similar 10-year output around almost the exact same time. And it just kept slipping me. It was Neil Young. From about 1969 to about 1979, dude put out some of the greatest fucking albums, like, and didn't release some of them too. Like, Homegrown and Chrome Dreams never came out until the last few years.
Yeah.
But everybody knows This Is Nowhere, After the Gold Rush, Harvest, On the Beach, Tonight's the Night, Zuma, American Stars and Bars, okay. Comes of Time was really good though. But then like fucking The Time Fades Away. Good Lord. Like, something about that, like 1969 to 1979, there was some absolutely fantastic music that took place during that time. And I think also really influenced a lot of music that came after there, especially like you can look at the impact that had on a lot of music that came out in the 90s, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
In the two, both of them. But yeah, so this whole conversation has just been a very long-winded way of saying, please listen to David Bowie.
Yeah, like, if you haven't,
like, seriously, there's something there for everybody. That the man has made some absolutely stellar music. And I guarantee if you just spend some time with his discography, if you're not familiar with it already, you will find something in there that you love and will open the door to a lot more music. He has worked with so many really interesting artists that, that he connected with through those years, like guys like Robert Fripp from King Crimson. And
Robert Fripp came up with the guitar riff on Heroes.
Yeah.
Quite possibly his most well-known song.
Yep. And you know, it's, if you're not into his music, go watch the movies he's been in, because he's a great actor too.
Mm-hmm.
Criminally underrated actor.
And there's a lot of really good documentaries about him too. Like Cracked Actor is a great documentary about him from the Thin White Duke era. There's a movie that came out about him last year. That was the first ever documentary authorized by his estate, called Moon Age Daydream.
I need to see that still.
Very, very good documentary. There are concert films like the Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders of Mars. It's a concert film that's very famous. Good. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I'll say too is, like, listen to his live albums. A lot of people, I feel like, do not listen to his live albums. I am personally an advocate for live albums to the degree that most of the time I will think that the live albums are actually better than the studio records.
I'm with you on that. I don't think live albums get as much love as they deserve, and some of my favorite albums are live albums.
Yeah, agreed. And there are a few, like, first of all, he does some fun covers when on his live records. Like he liked covering the Velvet Underground, and so there's a lot of Velvet Underground covers on his live records. But there will be times where just like a particular performance that he puts out on a live album just blows your mind. Like there's one live performance called Welcome to Blackout, which is a double live album from 1978. It's a performance in London. And on disc two, they do a performance of Station to Station into TVC15. So like literally my two favorite songs on Station to Station back to back. But the intro, if you've listened to Station to Station, there's this very extended intro before David Bowie starts singing where they use oscillating synthesizers to mimic a train. And then it's being played alongside this really killer bass line from Tony Visconti. And that intro goes on for 5 minutes as they keep changing tempo and keep adding different layers of effects to the synthesizers. And it just keeps building and building and building and building until finally his voice just comes out of the madness, like a bullet out of a gun, and it all stops. And it's the coolest freaking thing to experience in an auditory medium. I love it so much.
It's been a minute since I've listened to that. That might be my favorite of his live album.
It's really, really
it's
good.
It's really good.
Welcome to the Blackout is amazing.
Yeah.
Stage, the album that they released in that Thin White Duke era, is also really good. Make sure you listen to the 2017 version of it, though, because this is another sort of credit to David Bowie. He often was experimental at the cost of his career. And his studio people hated the Brian Eno collaborations, hated the ambient stuff that's on Heroes and Low, thought that it would kill his career. So when they released Stage, they asked Tony Visconti, when he was mixing it, to move all the ambient stuff out of the concert order and just put it all onto the second disc, and to add fake crowd noises to cover up the silence and boos that were present with some of the ambient stuff. And if you go on Spotify and look at his discography, you'll notice that a lot of his albums are getting remastered from like 2013 forward. And it's just been this project being led basically by Tony Visconti to remix and remaster all the albums to be in the best possible condition that they may have. And Stage in particular, Tony Visconti stripped out all that studio crap and then returned the track listing order to the proper way that it's supposed to be. So make sure you listen to that one. And also, as another point of order on the remixes, listen to Metrabilist, which is the 2020 remix of
Man Who Sold the World.
Man Who Sold the World with the terrible album art. That is
I used to have that on vinyl. That's the copy I had on vinyl.
That was the album art when they censored the drag cover.
Yep.
And now it's the drag cover is just the standard. I still don't really know what's going on in that painting, but that remix is incredible. It's such an amazing remix to the point where it similar to like the Giles Martin remixes of the Beatles, it almost unlocks another aspect of the record for you when you're listening to it. All the Mad Men on that remix in particular is mind blowing. And so there's a lot of really, really live material to dig into to dig in with his music as well. And I feel like it's just very overlooked by most people. The Nassau Coliseum performance in 76 is really, really good. The Live in Berlin record from 78 is really, really, really good. Like you just can't go wrong.
Yeah. I mean, we could keep going about Bowie all night.
Yeah, probably true. Probably true. Do you want to, I guess, as we circumvent that from happening, is there a starting point you want to close out on? Like, if somehow people here are like, yeah, I don't really know anything about David Bowie, or like, I've never listened to an album with David Bowie, kind of know, like, Under Pressure, and I don't even know what another...
Or probably, I mean, I know people who only know
Ace Oddity,
him from covers of his songs, like specifically like the Nirvana cover of Man Who Sold the World.
Right. Which is, it's better than the original.
It really, truly is. That Jesus, that whole Unplugged album is something. Mm-hmm. I could talk about that album all night too.
Something else.
Anyway, so as far as a starting point, I tend to kind of tell people, I don't think a lot of people are going to be able to jump right into something like Station to Station if they're not familiar with his stuff. I will say if you like experimental ambient music, then Station to Station is a good starting point, or Low. Either one of those, if you're willing to really sit down and give an album the time it deserves and really want to challenge your kind of, you know, musical taste, those are two great starting points. Right. If you're not really familiar with that type, if you're more into like straightforward rock music, or even into like alternative rock or something like that, Rise and Start, Falls of Ziggy Stardust or Aladdin Sane are great starting points for that. Or even if you're more of a, you like kind of a harder, darker, I hesitate to say angrier, but a more sort of heavy sound, I would say start with something like Outside or Earthling. It all kind of really depends on what you're already into, but that's kind of the beauty of the whole thing, is like there's really something there for everybody. Or if you like the heavier music, Man Who Sold the World has some heavy shit on there. There's some
really
great
does.
Heavy songs on there. If you like a sort of jazzier, smoother, more soulful sound, Young Americans is fantastic. I would just say, if you have some kind of a streaming service, go into his discography and just listen to a few songs and see what you think. And if that one doesn't really do it for you, then go to another album and see what that one does. And, just kind of play around. I can guarantee there is Bowie for everybody. So,
Yeah, I have two answers to that question. One, if I'm just going to answer the prompt as written, it's Diamond Dogs. Start with Diamond Dogs.
Ooh, okay, yeah.
Diamond Dogs lies directly in his discography at the end of the glam rock period, and just when he was starting to bottom out on drugs. So it has some songs that are slower and more melodic, like 1984, but it also has some songs that are harder edged and really energetic. It has some stuff on there that is sort of remaining from the glam rock era that he was sort of closing out, because that's really like the last Ziggy record.
Yeah.
And It's a concept album, so you get that idea out of Bowie as well, which he would repeat many times over the course of his career. And it gets a little bit experimental, where you can see where he's trying to kind of evolve his sound a bit more than he's been at for the past, you know, 5 years or so. So Diamond Dogs would be the album that I would tell people to begin with. But I would also say that Bowie is actually probably one of the only artists where I would say that the compilation LPs are worth listening to, from a standpoint of Changes 1 Bowie, Changes 2 Bowie, and Changes Now Bowie. I don't recommend starting with them, but if you're wanting to get like a taste of the different kind of musical flavors of each era of his career, those three compilation albums are really, really good to giving you that. Yeah. And if there's one or two songs that really stand out to you on those compilation albums, look up what album they're off of and then go to that album.
For sure. I generally don't find myself listening to Greatest Hits album, but that is a good starting point, I think, to a new listener. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Check those out, see what you like, and go find the album that it's from. And that's a good starting point for sure.
Plus, you get to hear three different versions of John, I'm Only Dancing.
Yeah.
Which never made it to an actual album, only on his compilation piece.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, so go listen to Bowie and branch out from there. You'll discover all kinds of music that either he directly influenced or he worked with. In some capacity or another, he's had his hands in so much of the music that you probably already enjoy and just mm-hmm. aren't aware of his influence on it.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. And he's just been an icon for so long.
Yeah. Yeah. And look what the world has become without him.
I know. So sad.
All right. Well, we'll be back next week. We start our coverage of our next book, Bleeding Edge. So hopefully you'll join us as we go through that book. I think we're all pretty excited to get back into the swing of things and to pick up our next Pynchon book. So we'll see you all next week.
Yeah, I feel capably prepared to host that one. and I'll throw out one note for everybody. I mentioned it already a couple weeks ago, but you now have one more week to watch We Live in Public, the documentary. I promise it is relevant, but I won't explain why yet.
You all have homework. Please make sure it's done on time.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll see you all next week. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.